Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is, did I say garage?
You did.
Yeah, well.
This is episode number 59.
Yes, and who is on this episode, Gina?
It is our lovely business line manager in Baltimore, Brian Russell.
And Ted.
Oh, and Ted Vitale. Oh, I didn't know it was a threesome.
Oh, okay, yeah.
All right. So we've got Ted Vitale and another business line manager and Fernando Rentes.
Yes.
Our third business line manager.
And I basically want to talk to those guys about what goes on in Baltimore. So tell me about the Baltimore office. What's going on over there?
Baltimore office is our birthplace for the U.S. Offices of Chaos Group LLC.
Right. And they mainly deal with the design market.
Yes.
That's most of their focus. Mm-hmm. And it's very, very interesting. All three of those guys have a very interesting perspective about where visualization is important in the design market. Not just architecture visualization, but just the design process itself, which is a big distinction that we make and describe in this podcast. So for those of you who come from ArcViz, or those of you who are architects, will understand the differences that we're talking about, because the fact that V-Ray lives in both worlds, we actually understand that there are two different markets for two different needs. So it was a really interesting chat with them. I was there just before the blizzard. So there was a big blizzard in Baltimore where I was stuck there for the rest of the weekend. So that's what we talk about a little bit. We talk about the fact that I was stuck in the snow for 2 days.
I saw the pictures. You have to post some of those. Those were interesting.
Yeah. I was stuck for 2 days there. But those guys are great. And I was really glad I went. They're really, really cool guys. All right, guys. Hope you enjoy it. Thanks.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fernell.
All right, we're already recording.
Excellent.
Excellent. You guys ready for the blizzard?
We are.
I think so. I got my salt. I got my shovel.
Salt. Salt and shovel. Okay.
Salt and shovel. That's what you need.
It's all you need. Well, also, you guys leaving early for to try to get home before it starts?
Yeah. I got a parking spot, so I'm Ubering home.
Really?
Yeah. I parked the car on Wednesday. I got a spot in front of the row house, and it's staying there until after the blizzard.
So really, it's worth Ubering just for a parking spot.
For $20, it's a lot better than a parking ticket or unburying your car from the corner spot or trying to find a spot at all.
Okay.
So,
you know the Boston trick, right?
Oh, the lawn chair?
The lawn chair.
Yeah. Well, it's a lawn chair or a brick through your window if you move the lawn chair. So.
Yeah.
We do that here, too.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, lawn chair just seems like, really? You put a lawn chair in a public street and that's supposedly your spot now.
And it's
dibs. It's like licking the cupcake.
It's generally respected, too.
All right. Okay. I'm a little, being from L.A. I used to go to school in upstate New York, so snow did not freak me out. But some reason, I don't know, the fact that I'm leaving on Monday and it's going to be a massive blizzard here is kind of freaking me out. And you have to leave early, Fernando, don't you?
Yes, I have to leave early, yes. I have to pick my kid at school. They have 2 hours early dismiss because of snow, so yes.
So you got to go. So
you have to go early.
Bet they're loving it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, they got a long weekend. I don't know. I'm going to hang out with my cousin for the weekend, and I don't know. We're probably going to be stuck in a house, but it'll be fun, I guess. Being stuck in a house and chatting is not so bad. All right. Let's talk a little bit about some stuff. I want to talk about the fact that many people don't realize, every time I came here and I talk about it going to Baltimore, don't realize that we actually have a Baltimore office. So why Baltimore? Why do we have a Baltimore office?
Do you want the full history on this?
Sure.
Give it to him, Brian.
So there's a mid-size architecture firm here in Baltimore, Air St. Gross Architects and Planners. They're roughly 170 folks, but about 10, 11, 12 years ago, something like that.
Yeah.
They purchased a little tiny visualization group called D3CG, and that was Corey Rubidoux's group.
Right.
To come in and do visualization for them. And I originally went to work with Corey, interestingly enough, at ASG back then. And about a year into doing visualization and implementing, you know, some new 3D technologies for the firm at that point in time, we decided, look, we really need to streamline our workflows. And so we hired a programmer by the name of Joe Bascalupa. Mm-hmm. And Joe started to program some plugins for us, and interestingly enough, came up with what would then become V-Ray for Rhino and V-Ray for SketchUp, and worked with the principals there and spun off a little group called ASG Viz.
Right.
Fast forward a few years, and Chaos Group proper decides that acquisition of ASG Viz would be a good move to make. And so as a result of that, we joined Chaos Group proper. I think it was a good marriage all the way around for everyone involved. Honestly, a really exciting opportunity for our guys, certainly. But I think the products that go out to the end users end up being that much better for it as well. So that's why Baltimore, interestingly enough, it started as you know, such a small seed, and it's amazing how it grew into this this thing that ultimately came back home, if you will.
Yeah. I think it's interesting for Chaos Group as well, because obviously they'd had an interest in having they have a huge client base in the United States, and they've been interested in opening an office here for a while, and that just seems like such a logical choice to make.
Yeah.
Like, why not just buy the company, and then now we have an office there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. So it was very cool to do that. And that also opened the door for them, you know, opening up an office in LA and other places as well. So how long have you been in the company, Fernando?
I've been in since 2008.
Okay.
So I started with ASGB in 2008. And
yeah.
Chaos Group acquired ASGB in February 2011.
Okay.
Yes.
So that's a while. And what was your focus the whole time when you were there?
Well, I was a 3D artist.
Uh-huh.
I remember the first week that I arrived to the company,
uh-huh.
they gave me the old manual that we have in Rhino, V-Ray for Rhino 1.5, and they told revise that and include all the new features that we have in 1.5.
Okay.
That was my first job here in the company.
So just rewriting the manual.
Rewriting the manual, yes.
Wow, okay. And so you've always been a Rhino user of some kind, or?
Well, my story is a little bit kind of different than those guys here.
Right.
I came from the CAD/CAM back in my native Puerto Rico. I was a 3D artist, a CAD/CAM designer.
Uh-huh.
We do Christmas ornaments and flatware. And I remember we have to create a pattern for a better one.
Mm-hmm.
I was a wedding designer here in the U.S.
Yeah.
We have to create a line of silverware.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to create the whole process, to create the mold, the CNC programming, and all this stuff to create the actual real piece,
mm-hmm.
to send the piece to here, U.S., from Puerto Rico to U.S. to get approval.
Right.
And that was we have to spend a lot of money doing that. And by the time that the model arrived here, they didn't like it, they have to return it back, and we have to start the whole process again.
Mm-hmm.
So I start including V-Ray in the workflow to actually, instead of sending the actual pieces, I send rendering to the Vera One team,
right.
and they approve all the model from the renders. Then I just came here to US and mm-hmm. applied for the job, and they hired me, and yes, that was my background, coming from the CAD/CAM designer.
Interesting. To a 3D. So how were you doing V-Ray back then? How long? That was a while ago, I guess.
That was in 2006, I guess, yes.
Right. Yeah, so V-Ray was only a few years old at that point.
It was V-Ray 1.0. For Rhino, it was 1.0.
Right.
And by that time, it was kind of, okay. So I made half of the model in 3D Max
mm-hmm.
and half of the rendering in Rhino.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I guess basically you must have been using Corey's group's ASG Viz's plugin at that point, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I was using V-Ray for Rhino since the first version.
Wow, I didn't realize Viva Ferrano went back that far. Wow, all right. And what about Viva for SketchUp, around the same time?
Yes, it was Viva for SketchUp and Viva for Rhino. They are being twin brothers since the beginning. So
okay.
Basically twin brothers.
Right. Okay. And you guys just moved into this new office recently, right?
Yeah, within, I guess it was, we've been here about a year now. February 1 last year was
We're right up on a year.
Yeah, okay. We're coming right up on a year. So this was kind of a cool office because my background is architecture. I came from Good Fulton Farrell Architects, and I got brought on in 2013, I guess it was, mostly because I kept sending scenes that was breaking things. It was funny coming here.
If we hire this guy, he's going to annoy us less.
Oh, right? Well, yeah, pretty much. So it was funny because I sent in a couple of scenes and I got brought on and I'm sitting and I'm digging through some of the support scenes. I'm, oh, hey, I recognize that. That's what I sent in.
Right.
So I got hired on after I was breaking things and emailing Joe and Devin and the dev team at that time. And once I was here, we started looking for new office space shortly thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
And we had also picked up Ben Hurlbutt. He's a 3D artist on the Revit side, and he also does SketchUp and Rhino stuff. And between Ben and I and Fernando, once we got the space, we started putting together designs for the office and what furniture we wanted and everything else.
Yeah.
And that was really kind of fun because it just was a nice transition from the architecture stuff to the Viz stuff right off the bat.
I think it's cool that, you know, Long and I were doing kind of a similar thing when we moved to the office in Culver City. It's like we can lay this out ourselves.
Yeah.
We can do this.
I still want those lights, the tube frame lights.
Those are cool lights.
Yeah, we can get Daniel to make another one of those. We can commission. That's easy. I actually want him to do a dome light as well.
Yeah, there you go.
A little dome light would be cool.
I'm still trying to figure out how you do the IES light.
That's going to be a complicated one. Yeah, it's going to be something with weird arrows and kind of something very strange, I think. It'll be cool. Yeah, we can figure it out.
Yeah.
We'll just model up something and then we'll build it.
I imagine one of those, you know, those dynamic sculptures with all the spheres on them that can move depending on what information is put in.
Really?
Maybe we could put one of those together.
We can actually feed it IES files.
Exactly, and it'll change the IES shape on the fly.
All right.
Yeah. Somewhere out there, someone is taking this idea and building it.
Yeah, it'd be really, really hilarious. Awesome. I don't think it'd be that hard.
A lot of little motors.
Servos.
Easy. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's getting cheap.
Sure.
Do that.
Sure. Yeah. Trip to Fry's and we're all done.
Pretty much.
All right. Well, cool. And I remember the first time I met you was in Chicago, Ted.
Yes. We went out listening to jazz and drinking good scotch. And
that's right.
That was a good night. That was
AIA in Chicago.
Yeah.
Not that we had a fantastic steak dinner. Chicago, and by the way, if you're going to have steak anywhere in the world, it's one of the top 10 places, I'd say. I don't know, because I haven't been to Argentina. That's the only thing I can say. Argentina and New Zealand, I think those are the other places to try. But
Texas does good steak, too.
Nah, not like Chicago.
Yeah, that's true.
See, here's the problem. Okay, here's my theory on steak and why steak is better in Chicago than it is in Texas. Because Texas is not aged, right?
It's all about size.
No. And the reason it's good in Chicago is historically it's aged naturally because they would put it on the train. It was slaughtered in Texas or St. Louis or whatever, and they put it on a train, and it would age as it would go up on the train to Chicago. And by the time it got to Chicago, it was the proper age of the meat, and so that's why it tastes better there.
So, Chris, we're coming right up on lunch here, so you're not helping me.
All right. So, but what was really interesting, what I liked what you did is you've always been a tinker. You're always thinking design, Ted. You're always thinking about new, cool ideas and stuff, which is great. And I remember you were one of the people that came up with the Wiki booth thing.
Yeah, Corey brought it to my attention. I had heard of Wiki House is the company.
Yeah.
And they
I really
also
want
do,
to talk to those guys at some
they're,
point.
They're cool dudes. They're a lot of fun. So Corey had this idea, oh, hey, what if we did our booth as a wiki house? That would be really neat. So
I should give people a little bit of a history about what wiki house is about, because so, people may not know that. There's actually a TED talk on the wiki house.
Not actually me talking about wiki house.
No, not you.
Let me clarify that. this is also a TED talk about wiki house. Yeah. But WikiHouse is a group of artists in the UK, or architects, I should say, who had this idea that, hey, why are we wasting so much energy and resources on building a house in this more traditional sense where it's, you know, 2x4s and nails and screws, and why don't we kind of CAD-CAM the crap out of this and make it a little bit more interesting. So what they came up with is a flat pack system of CNC routed plywood, and it's put together in such a way that it links together almost, I guess, like a Lincoln log set. Well, that's wrong. Maybe you remember those old wood models that you would get as a kid that were just like clicked together wood models that you'd build a boat or an airplane or something like that. They were sort
pieces.
Of a puzzle.
But they're three-dimensional
puzzles. Puzzle pieces, yeah.
Right.
So it's the same concept. So it links together like that, and they're all joined by these pressure joints, very, very much like Japanese style woodworking, only not as pretty in modern day, I guess is the best way to describe it. So it wedges together, and once it's in place,
it's all pre-cut, no nails.
Yeah,
nothing. And it's all just wedging friction and wedging.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because they open source the whole concept or the whole idea.
Yeah. Right? So they've got WikiHouse, and they've also got WikiDesk. So you can actually get on there, design stuff, and post your design ideas, and then sell the flats to people who want to build it, or sell the designs to a local CNC shop. So you can order a desk to be cut at your nearest shop. Mm-hmm. So the cool thing about this whole process was the fact that Corey's like, hey, talk to these guys, see what you guys can come up with. I want to do a booth like this.
Mm-hmm.
Said, all right. So Ben and I kind of got on the horn with this. I wish I could remember his name. I'm going to have to look it up, and maybe we can post it in comments somewhere later. But
sure.
I emailed WikiHouse, and we started coordinating with their lead architect. Essentially, he said, go ahead, grab all of our files, whatever you need, and kind of put it together, and I'll go ahead and fix whatever needs to be fixed. So Ben and I started tinkering with what it would look like, how it would go together. And in the process, we learned a lot of things about, okay, how to go about modifying their objects that they give you, because it's all on SketchUp. Mm-hmm. It's all on 3D Warehouse, and they also have a little plugin for SketchUp called WikiHouse where it'll export all the flats.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's pretty cool. So we got the house in, we started modifying it, we tweaked a lot, and we, you know, put the visualizations together and sent it back to him, as well as the files. And essentially he was like, well, I don't have to do anything. I mean, I would consider changing this or that, but you guys figured this out pretty quick.
Wow, yeah.
So go for it. I think it's good to go to print. So we found a small shop in Chicago that does CNC routing. And we just sent him the CAD file, and he said, okay, I'm going to do a couple of tweaks to it, and I'll have you a box ready to go on the day of the show. So I flew out a little early, got to the show, started putting it together, got a few skunky looks from some of the trade show union guys, because I was putting together my own booth, and apparently that's a no-no in Chicago.
No-no in any any convention center.
But then again, they also looked at what I was doing and were like, I want nothing to do with that.
Yeah. It's like, trust me, I know what is going on.
Yeah. So it's all in the head, man. Right. Yeah. So we started putting it together, and sure enough...
it took you almost like less than a day to do it.
Yeah, right? It was really more trying to figure out where all the pieces went, because it was a big jigsaw puzzle the first time, because I'd never built one of these things. And we had some help from Jeremy Kay. He was an architect from JDK Studios, and Corey, and you and Lon helped pull it apart, I think.
By the time I got there, it was all set up.
Yeah, so Yeah, now the nice part about all this is after the show, we took it all apart, and it's now sitting as the front reception area of our office with a big flat screen TV and a couple of video games hooked up to it. So it's fun when we need a little break from doing whatever we're doing. Just go sit down.
I know because Fernando has to leave early, so we will probably take a break. I have a couple more questions for you, so don't leave yet, but I'm going to take a break. So that we can take a Polaroid in front of it. So it'll be part of the thing. Cool. But one thing I liked, well, just a quick side note about what I liked about the WikiHouse thing, is it actually got so much attention on the show floor because AIA is mostly geared towards architects, right? Yeah. And so some of these people didn't really know about technology stuff or whatever. And so they'd come by and say, is this about a new building system? They were all like surprised about it. It's like, no, actually, did we just build this at our booth? And we're actually Chaos Group. It's like, oh. Okay, and so we had their attention, you know?
So what's Chaos Group?
So what's Chaos Group? But they would never have stopped there for some random reason if it wasn't for the booth. And the booth actually was a really cool attention grabber. And I love the fact that you were designing it and you were sending us renderings. We're like, what do you think about now? I was like, man, I don't know. Maybe the TV's too high. Maybe do this. And we did a few adjustments. And we basically went through a design process of filming that.
Yeah. I mean, the same thing happened with our office here. We went through probably two or three different types of furniture before we found the furniture we wanted and layout styles and artwork and everything else. So
that's cool.
It's cool.
So, Fran, I want to go real quick because I know some of the your time is short, and I want to make sure we cover some of the things I want to talk about. And I want to talk about industrial design. Yeah. and some we've done some really cool stuff that's happened in industrial design, obviously. And that's been mostly your world at this point, right?
Yes.
So you're very much you're the product manager for V-Ray for Rhino mostly, or that's your focus really.
So
right
now I'm the BLM for the V-Ray for Rhino.
Right.
But yeah, we all worked on the, I guess, all the facets of the software.
Sure.
Understanding the feature that we want to include, understanding the marketing, the market that we want to affect. So we also are involved in the whole process. Yes.
Right. And that Rhino group is very interesting. Like, as industrial design has changed recently in a lot of ways, because I think a lot of people are doing a lot more parametric design and interesting design. There's a lot of people using like Grasshopper and stuff like that. So people who don't understand what Grasshopper is, can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, Grasshopper, I'm not a Grasshopper guy, but Grasshopper is a kind of a parametric logic way to create models or structures. So you could basically create components and links to the component with the design, and behind the whole environment, you could create basically a logic system where you could control different aspect of the modeling process.
Right.
And that modeling process is going to be parametric. So you could modify one setting and the whole thing get adjusted to that setting that you modify.
Right. And that's kind of cool because you're actually starting to see buildings being built that way.
The cool thing is that you could create form that you will never imagine that you could do it before with the regular modeling systems.
And so, how is the construction of all these things happening now? Because obviously a lot of it is just you've created some beautiful form of some kind. You got to figure out how to build it, right?
Yes, some of them are like pet mansions.
Right.
We have guys. This is kind of crazy because architects are using the whole system.
Right.
But also pro designer that you mentioned, sculptor guys are using the Grasshopper to create sculpture.
Right.
And arts.
Right.
And they use router. They use 3D printer. They use all the technology that you have available right now to create all those forms.
But it's kind of scary if you create this parametric system or something that's very unusual or possibly very expensive to create or at least prototype of some kind. So visualization of that is going to be critical, right?
Absolutely.
And that's exactly what you're telling us about, what you went through over in Puerto Rico, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So how is that work in terms of V-Ray? How are the clients working with V-Ray in terms of that?
Right now, at this point, you have to actually bake the Grasshopper geometry in order to be able to render to render the geometry.
Sure.
But Matt, one of the V-Ray for Rhino developers, he's actually make plugins. We are working on that right now, where you could actually render the Grasshopper geometry without having to bake the geometry.
Right inside a Grasshopper, you'll be able to render.
Able to render, because right now you have to basically break the parametric situation right. in order to be able to render that.
Yeah.
And we don't want to the user break that parametric
Yeah, you don't function. Want or create instances because it kind of loses the functionality right. of it. Yeah.
So the whole idea is while you're working in Grasshopper, while you're working in the parametric situation where you're moving setting to yep. control the size or scale or whatever.
Yep.
You could use WeaveIRT and see the result.
And this is a lot of this is happening, is being enabled now because of V-Ray App SDK.
Right.
And V-Ray App SDK is sort of enabling us to put V-Ray into things way, way quicker than anything else.
Right.
I swear we're going to have V-Ray for Angry Birds before you know it. Because, yeah. So, but I think that that's really kind of an interesting concept of that design process. Mm-hmm. The Rhino group of people, and I think actually the SketchUp guys as well, the fast iteration of design concepts are really, really critical. And being able to render those is important because I yeah. think there's certain representations that are at different levels that carry through. And I think that rendering is critical. And even in rough form, you can get nice renderings out of V-Ray that you would like to make sure function right.
Yes, another thing that is pretty cool about V-Ray is that in the industrial design area is that most of the guys that are doing modeling, mm-hmm. they actually want to create a physical object to sell it.
Right.
And they want to create package and they want to create images for packaging.
Right.
So V-Ray is going to allow you to not only in the modeling, in the design process, to be able to study forms because the reflection, because the lights, you can actually use the visualization services of V-Ray to create the package for the object.
Right.
So you could send your model to whatever China to be done.
Right.
And while it's doing in China, you are working your package here in US, you know, with the visualization, with the renders.
Yeah. And it creates good reference too.
Absolutely.
Like it's got to look like this.
Yes.
You know, so that's a really cool
idea.
We
have guys using V-Ray even for create the instruction to create houses. So one, I visit Colombia in one of my trips and yeah. there was a guy that I do prefabric houses, small houses.
Yeah.
And they have a whole manual how to create the house and they render
They
render it using V-Ray Toon, for example.
That's great. It's like, oh, here you go. Here's how to build it. And here's like literally pretty pictures of showing you the assembly process.
Right.
And I wanted to kind of jump in there. I've actually seen this in practice in the construction industry as well, where the architect will actually take a rendering that they've made of the interior space, and they went into each room of the building mm-hmm. and put a 24 by 36 inch printed rendering in that room for reference for the construction yes. guys
well, that
so they know, hey, yeah. this is what it's supposed to look like. If it doesn't look like this when you're done with it, you didn't do it right.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. Wrong. It's the opposite of what happens in visual effects, because what we do is we take pictures of things that we're supposed to match and say, make sure the rendering looks like that.
It's
the other way around, where you actually use the renderings, because that's the whole point of architecture, is we're building things that haven't been built before, right? So we have to match a set or something
and
like that.
Yeah, you're seeing it actually in construction documents where they'll call out a rendering right. as a reference image. I've seen it in a few documents now
right.
that, hey, this is what it's supposed to look like afterwards. This is our level of detail that we need you guys to focus on.
Yeah.
Go.
Yeah.
So
I remember a conversation specifically like that when there was a contractor took a rendering and showed it to the architect, says, this is the rendering it's supposed to look like. See? So don't tell me that it's not supposed to look like that. So it actually goes both ways.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Cool. All right. I want to make sure you have time to go, and I want to make sure we have time for this picture. So I'm going to pause the podcast, and we come back, and I'm going to talk about some BIM stuff with Brian, because I think that would be cool for us to talk about as well.
Cool.
All right. Hold on a second. I'm pausing, guys, and we'll be right back. Okay, 1, 2, 3. All right, we're back.
Woo!
Okay.
All right. So what did you pick up?
I picked up an old Polaroid, the one with the billows.
Yes.
And there's a thread online that shows you how to swap out the original wired-in battery for a new replacement battery for like a 9-volt, so you can use the thing. I still don't know where to get film for it yet, but I'm tinkering. I picked it up about a month ago.
So I was looking at that, and I could find it online, and it had some of those old school. I was like, yeah, I'm going to get that. But it was way more expensive, and I was like, I'm not paying $250 for a Polaroid camera. So
wait, the camera itself?
There's just a camera.
Oh, man.
Like the old school Billows ones that go, whoop, you know, pop see, up.
I found it at a flea market for like $12.
Well, that's what I got
to
do.
That's the best way to do it.
Yeah, that's what I got to do. I got to go to find it at that. But anyway, I found this whole thing. It's like, it's a refurb, so they kind of guarantee it a little bit, you know, and it comes in a little camera bag and one roll of film, and it was like significantly cheaper. So I was like, all right, that's good. But it's cool. I think, you know, it was Melissa's idea. I said, I wanted to do this this book, like a guest book of some kind. It's mostly because of Nerdist. I know I copy everything from Nerdist in terms of the podcast. But Nerdist has this thing where they had a guest book that I haven't seen it, but I've heard about it on the episodes that looks like a Wookiee. And they have all the guests sign it.
That's awesome.
And so at the end, when it's all filled up, they're going to give it away to charity or donate or, you know, raise money for charity to get away or something. But I said, I want to do something like that. And then Melissa said, why don't we do Polaroids? I said, where am I going to find a Polaroid? And then I was like, this could be really cool. And it's I think it looks great. And I'm sort of making that the new pictures that go up there. So that'd be cool. You like it?
Yeah.
Yeah, analog, baby. It was so funny. Corey's son yesterday, we took it out after the podcast. He's like, what is that? He thought it was the latest, coolest thing. I was like, oh. And then Corey just looked at each other and burst out laughing because, you know, 13-year-old kid has never seen that. There was a kid, someone put out a thing where I showed my son a floppy disk, and he says, oh my God, you 3D printed the save icon. I was like, yeah, no, that's called a floppy disk. All right, let's get into BIM. I want people to understand that. Oh, I'm going to move this mic. Hold on a second.
Okay.
All right, so let's get into BIM. You can move closer now just so that when you turn your head, it's easier. How has architecture design changed, and let's say in the last 10 years? What's been the move in that design phase? Because I think it's really interesting for people to understand that.
Well, I think the run-up to the big move to BIM, and certainly we're there now, I think, was 3D modeling buildings. You know, we went from hand drawing to drafting in CAD-based systems.
Like AutoCAD.
All representational. You know, these lines mean something, but you have to know how to read the lines in order to understand, right? And
sure.
Then we started to even do some 3D work, maybe in some later versions of AutoCAD 10 years ago. And now we're really capturing the whole of buildings. In building information modeling, BIM. As we're referring to it. And, you know, 10 years ago at ASG as an example, Air St. Gross that I was talking about earlier, most of the designers, safely say 90% of the designers sketched everything by hand, moved to a CAD system to document it, did zero 3D work.
Right.
Because there was no reason for them to do 3D at that point in time, at least in their minds, other than to take it out to visualization. And of course,
they did hire ASG Viz to do that or whatever.
Exactly. And so what we found is that, you know, we were a small group, four or five people then. What we found is that we were constantly modeling these architectural plans.
Yep.
And interpreting these drawings into buildings so that design decisions could be made. And we said, you know, there's got to be a better way than this.
Yeah. I remember bringing in CAD drawings and, you know, snapping all the lines together over the wall and extruding up and then punching windows. And I spend most of my time modeling.
Spend most of your time cleaning up the line work.
Yeah, cleaning up the line work. Like,
because nothing was ever connected.
Or somehow someone put like annotation lines in the wrong layer and then that would get extruded and it became
right.
a wall.
That's right. I can't tell. Countless hours. You know, it was not uncommon back then to do, you know, 15 to 18 hour days just cleaning up drawings that you could extrude and then yep. apply materials and UVs to and yeah. all that good fun stuff.
Yeah.
That's all really almost been hidden under the hood these days.
Yeah.
You know, we're doing object-based
That was
modeling.
Very surprising to me. I'm just going to sort of sidetrack because what was interesting when I talked to the guys at the 3D Symposium, which is mostly an ArcViz guys, which is different from architecture, and this is something, a distinction I want people to make, because BIM is about the design process and ArcViz is about people that are creating beautiful renderings and representing of the design, and that's a different group. But those guys, some of those, there's companies that are unbelievable and specialized in that, right? And I was talking to like some of the guys at Mir were incredible renderings. And I was like, oh, we have 2 days to do these renders. And I was like, how do you have 2 days to do that? And it's like, it would take me 2 days to model the building. It's like, oh, we don't model the building.
Right. That's right.
It's like, no. We don't model the building. The building, we get that model, or if it's not correct, and we, you know, it's like we have to clean it up, the model. Sometimes it comes in from Revit or whatever, but like, no, the modeling process is the design process now, right?
That's right. That's absolutely right. And it's amazing in that designers now have more power at their fingertips than they've ever had,
right,
in the history of construction. And it's, what's most interesting about it is that we're doing it out of necessity. I mean,
right, but it's almost natural, right? Just the fact, to me, the fact that an architect is actually modeling all the time naturally is kind of interesting, right?
Sure.
But doesn't it force them, you know, because here's the issue, right? When I was an architect many years ago and I was doing stuff, everyone always thought in plan elevation. So it was basically they were doing two different kinds of designs. They're doing a plan and they're doing an elevation, they're doing a section. And they thought basically architecture was two-dimensional. And if you think about it, everything was a two-dimensional representation of their design process. Now they see it in 3D all the time, naturally, right?
That's correct.
I think that's the shift, yeah.
In fact, what's interesting to me is that I've spent the last really 10 years teaching people to unlearn that 2D logic and to start thinking in 3D again,
yeah.
Right. Because it had become so much of the vocabulary
right.
for the designers to think. You know, they're thinking in 3D and they're translating it to 2D and it almost becomes second nature. And so they almost forget to design in 3D.
Right.
And so I've spent a lot of time teaching people, hey, you can let go of thinking about it as a floor plan and start to think about it as a whole building again, as a space, as you know, time and place.
Uh-huh.
And it's fascinating how that shift has it's amazing how much of their design has freed up because of that shift.
Yeah, I would think they would find it more daunting. And maybe it is at first, right?
I think initially it is. And and certainly I've seen it, especially as we get older.
Right.
It's harder to let go of those things that are familiar.
Right.
But what's interesting is once they see it and once they understand it, once that trigger happens in the brain, then mm-hmm. it's almost a sea change, very, very suddenly.
Okay.
And so it's, yeah, it takes a while. Younger folks come in, they're much easier to transition. They've experimented with 3D technologies, maybe in school, in architecture school.
Yeah.
Folks who've been in the industry a few years, they're a little bit harder to transition out of that 2D mentality and into the 3D mentality. But
yeah.
But once they do, it's amazing to watch that transformation.
I absolutely agree. And I think what was interesting with Ted, when we were in Chicago, that was the, you know, like I said, I hadn't been in that world in a long time. And part of me felt that I felt that the quality of renderings I was seeing, and most of, I got to say, this is very different, right? And again, this is separation that has happened since I've left. Most of the quality of the renderings I'm seeing out of stuff comes from the ArcViz world because it makes for very, very pretty renderings. And most of those guys are not architects even, right? Yeah. Those guys are just really good. They're matte painters in a sense, right? But they're beautiful, beautiful, very photorealistic work. And obviously we've been part of that world for a long time. But when I came to AIA and we're sitting at that, you know, beautiful booth and people were coming by, it's like, oh yeah, I know V-Ray. I use it in SketchUp. They all used it in SketchUp, right? They didn't use it in Max as much. Very few people were Max guys because that's not that crowd.
I think it's just Max seems very overwhelming to an architect.
Right. So let's go back to your analogy of the 10 years ago, the old guys, at, well, I don't want to say old guys, but the people at ASG were working, or any architecture firm at that time was working, they would hand sketch things and then go into CAD. So that hand sketch thing now has been replaced by SketchUp, right? Mm-hmm. So the transition of going from 2D to 3D happened all the way down to the initial idea process, and SketchUp has now served, has replaced the vellum, right?
Yeah.
Has replaced the sheets of paper and the pencils.
I mean, the process is still almost exactly the same. I would see it all the time. You would get the really rough hand sketch and they'd say, okay, I need you to take this and do something with it. And you'd pull it into CAD and you'd do it in CAD. Essentially, now they do the same thing. Here's this SketchUp thing that I created. It's really rough. And
it's a massing model.
It's a terrible massing model, usually,
right.
too.
Right.
But it's got the volume and, okay, here, go.
Right.
So I think I see a transition happening, even with the more, I don't want to say older, seasoned architects.
Mm-hmm.
The more seasoned architects are picking up SketchUp and are just like, oh, yeah, this makes sense, because it is just a very free-form tool that you can do just about anything in. There aren't too many rules or regulations involved in creating these models, but hey, I've got the freedom. It feels like I'm doing sketch models back in college. That's the thing.
I got a question for you, because I want to sort of get my kids into SketchUp, to believe it or not.
Okay.
What would be a good resource for me to get a kid started, like really initial stuff, to start in SketchUp?
Show them the extrude tool and the pencil tool. Okay. Those are the two. So it's funny because my mom's a teacher. She's retired now, but she was a teacher with Broward County Schools for 35 years, something like that. And one of the things she tasked me with doing when I came back from school after, this is in 2009, she's like, hey, I've got a class of kids that so-and-so is teaching. Mm-hmm. You do 3D stuff and they're doing a thing on design and you want to try and teach them your 3D program?
Mm-hmm.
So I got 25 fifth graders in a room with some laptops and they all had SketchUp downloaded and ready. I showed them how to use the rectangle tool.
You can still get the free SketchUp?
Oh, yeah. SketchUp Make is still free for educational use or for hobbyist use, personal use, as long as you're not selling the things.
Right.
SketchUp Make is free for anybody who wants to tinker with it. It's great. But I pretty much got the entire class on SketchUp Make and said, okay, this is your pencil tool. You can draw lines with it. Mm-hmm. This is your rectangle tool. You can draw squares and rectangles with it. Mm-hmm. And this is your circle tool.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Those are your three, we'll call them primitives, even though they're not necessarily primitives.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this tool here is your extrude tool. So you can make that square cube go.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't tell them anything else.
Right.
I had kids making sailboats. I had one kid who built an entire skate park in about 20 minutes.
Right.
Just picked it up.
Yeah. See, because this is going to be a graduation from Minecraft, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Because
they're making stuff in Minecraft all the time, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, my son just sits there and tinkers and tinkers. I don't even know. I think he's just making and destroying and making and destroying and making and destroying and, breaking down this and my own doll here. So that's what he does. So that's his pastime.
Well, I think had I had a SketchUp as a kid, I would have been doing the same thing, because pretty much I was doing that with SimCity 2000.
Right.
Like when you got a Mac back in the day, I had the PowerPC 6400 as our first home computer. And that was, it came with like SimCity 2000. And I was like, oh, this is great. And I figured out how to mod the cities and terrain changes. And it was just like, this is great.
Yeah.
I had SketchUp, I'd been all over it back
then. Yeah, I think, and what's cool is that SketchUp goes from that to all the way being literally a major design tool for the architecture community.
You have IFC tagging in it now, so you can do building information modeling from SketchUp and translate that to Tekla and Revit and any of the other BIM-based modeling systems now.
So, it's pretty, yeah, that's cool.
Pretty robust.
Yeah, I like the fact that a lot of these tools, like, you know, even Rhino and SketchUp and Revit, they know that those tools need to translate to each other. Right.
Absolutely. I mean, part of the reason why we're doing BIM today is because of an old NIST study back in, I want to say, 2004. A lot's been published, was published about it between 2004 and 2007. But basically, average project, architecture project, construction project, 3% of the total budget to construct it is spent in interoperability for software.
Mm-hmm.
Now think about that at a much broader scale. I think you're talking about $1.6 billion annually that gets wasted in our software not talking to each other
right.
in the construction field. And so we needed to solve that. That plus a severe decline in productivity in the construction market
sure.
versus all other non-farm. And so that set the stage for us to look towards technology to solve some of these problems, and building information modeling started to do that. What's amazing to me is part of this transition and part of why we've, you know, had to do this is yes, it's freed us up. Yes, it's changed our thinking. Yes, it's changed our design to some degree, but it's very real problem solving, if you will,
mm-hmm.
From the software perspective that's had to lead us to this stage.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that making all of those things work is something that I believe that the visual effects industry could learn from. They've been trying to struggle with figuring out how to operate between all of their different packages. And so, you know, there's people coming up with standards. There's obviously Alembic that's trying to be a standard. I think Pixar is trying to come up with a universal scene description file. But the fact is that people who are Maya people, they stick to Maya. People who are Max people, they stick to Max, and
sure.
they stick to Houdini. Every now and then, people don't jump back and forth that much. You know, in fact, they're like, we are a Maya shop, we are a Max shop. So they don't really do that much. But I think the idea of being able to jump back and forth between different packages and being able to do that is really important. I think it's also cool the fact that we've made V-Ray available in all those packages and trying to make sure that people can go back and forth between those things, right? And that's one of the things
correct.
I think that's happened in V-Ray for Revit, which is an important part, and we're going to get to more detail on that, is that you can take what you've initiated inside of Revit and just translate that over to Max, right? And even if you're not doing the visualization, even if you're not doing a beautiful ArcViz rendering, you can at least give someone a good head start on what you're doing, right?
That's absolutely correct.
Right.
I mean, and as we continue to progress forward, I think the way those two work together,
mm-hmm.
The way you're able to capture some of the material libraries, things of that nature,
mm-hmm.
Becomes almost the most significant part of what we're doing in that process.
Right. Well, let me talk a little bit, because actually both of your packages, and I'm not sure so much about Rhino, but I know that both of your packages, the interface for V-Ray is a lot different than it is in the Max world and Maya world, which can have a whole lot of options. And you guys are not as interested in skin and hair, right?
That's true.
You know, unless you're doing a Zaha Hadid building, then maybe you are. But there's a lot of really a workflow that has to be simple in a lot of ways. And so you guys have thought about the simplicity of the workflow that's coming out of this area. So talk to me a little bit about that and how you feel it's different and where you feel the more complex buildings or the more complex workflow fits in as opposed to the workflow that's coming out of Revit right now.
Sure. Well, I think first and foremost, it was important to us as architectural visualization guys from the start to understand the difference between someone who's going to set up behind Max or Maya
mm-hmm.
and really create, you know, full-blown animations, of architectural projects, or they're going to do super high-end visualization. Mm-hmm. The way they see things is very, very different from the designer. And so we went out, we actually spoke to hundreds of firms, literally hundreds of architecture, engineering, and construction firms, reached out to all of them and said, how do you do visualization today? What's important to you? What isn't important to you? And what's interesting is the desire for simplification in the rendering process for most of these folks. Mm-hmm. They want to not have to focus on rendering. It should be a byproduct of what they're doing as part of their design process. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's an important part of the design process because it gives you visual feedback on what it is that you're doing. Mm-hmm. And I can come back to an example that we've done at ASG where we're actually swapping materials using RTGPU, V-Ray RT, mm-hmm. on the GPU, swapping materials in real time and making design decisions. Mm-hmm. You know, that's something new in our vocabulary. We've never had before.
Right.
That ability.
And this is not some architect sitting behind an ArcVis person making those decisions. This is the architect or him or herself, right?
That's right. That's the designer themselves. And so what became really important to us is let's take all of that knowledge or as much of that knowledge as we can, mm-hmm. from some of the best artists in the world, and let's bake these settings in some quick settings, not button simple. I won't call it button simple, but let's make it as easy as we can.
Right.
For them to get in and be able to render and not have to worry about light theory, for instance.
Sure.
Or all of the things that go behind setting up the perfect rendering solution to make it fast and make it look as good as you want it to.
Right.
At the same time, we understand that there are limitations to doing that. And so mm-hmm. we still support that ArcVis guy who's still going to have that knowledge. They'll be able to go into Max, for instance, mm-hmm. take that project, add that level of spit and polish that you wouldn't get otherwise.
Sure. But I mean, literally those settings in Revit are like high, medium, low, very high or whatever, right?
That's really simple. Correct. Yeah.
So they don't even have to worry about those settings. And it simplifies the process. In fact, most of the materiality comes from right out of Revit, right?
That's correct. We're doing translation of the materials that are already in your scene. You have the ability to load in if you've already got VR mats. You can bring those in.
Oh, you can bring in VR mats. Okay.
You can also use it was really important to us in Revit specifically to be non-destructive to the building information modeling database, which mm-hmm. means you have to use what's built in Revit natively mm-hmm. For materials. So you can bring in your maps. You can use the Autodesk shaders that are built in there. You can manipulate things, and we do a translation at render time mm-hmm. of those materials. So we're completely non-destructive in that regard. Mm-hmm. But you also have the ability to do a material override. Mm-hmm. And this is actually it points to something interesting that to the best of my knowledge, you haven't been able to do in Revit directly, and that's that you can actually do a material override on the whole of your building. So if you want it to look like basswood, you can throw basswood at it, and then we'll read the transparent materials out separately, and you can apply plastic or glass to those. Mm-hmm. And suddenly you've got a model that looks just like the study model that you're going to go into your wood shop and build.
Oh, that's cool.
So you can really focus on form and light.
Right, because some people don't want to have it all look exactly right.
Absolutely, and that's been one of our challenges. Is in earlier design phases, the client doesn't want to see a photoreal rendering.
Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, they don't want to show something too early. It always, and that's true across all kinds of stuff. Everyone is very worried that people think, is that what it looks like? Or, you know, that's not what I want it to look. Or sometimes people feel that you've already designed it and built it.
Right.
When it's an early stage. And that freaks people out as well. So if you show it as a model, then it looks like, oh, okay, well, you haven't really built it yet.
We had one problem with that at my old firm is we showed them the renderings of a model and they were like, well, that's great. When can you have the model over to our office? We'd love to display it.
Right. Yeah.
So
yeah.
We were like, no, that's not an actual model. It's a rendering of a model, but we can also do that.
Yeah.
If you'd like to spend that money as well.
Because that's expensive. Building models can be expensive. It's funny, it's interesting. We were one in architecture school, there was someone who had built she made a basswood model of the Tempietto, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And she beautiful. She's just an incredible model, and it's, you know, it's an iconic piece of architecture. And so she made it, and so we put it out there because we were all supposed to do, you know, the idea of understanding how to make models and stuff. And some alumni at Rice saw it and said, "I'd like to buy it from you." And so she said, "Well, you know," I was like, "Yeah, it cost me a lot of money to make that. Like, I was like, you know, maybe $100 worth of wood." And the teacher's like, "You don't understand. How much time did you spend on this? That's what it costs, you know." And so it's like, he says, "Well, what should I ask for?" I says, "Enough money for you to go see the real Tempietto." It's like, oh, okay, I get it now. So making models. And that's the thing that's cool about the rendering process is you can do that.
Well, it's all about thinking in three dimensions. I mean, model making as a traditional endeavor translates over to model making as a digital endeavor.
Yeah.
And they translate really well.
Well, you know what's cool is looking at Shane. Did you see Shane's VR thing, the Oculus?
Yes.
Thing
he did? Okay. Yeah.
And he actually has a mode in the Oculus which makes it look like a model. Right?
Oh, I didn't see that.
Yeah, you
one.
Click this button, you're inside the building.
Oh, wait, where it pulls you out of the model.
Pulls out the model and it sits great. On a yes, pedestal. I know you're talking and you're looking about at it, it's like, oh, now it looks like a model. And then you can walk around it like it's a model. Totally gets it. Like, he understands that architects what they want to see and how they operate. So yeah, that model view thing is really cool. Now, how is the, I mean, what is the quality render that's coming out of Revit, and how is that helping the architect specifically? And how is that different from ArcViz?
Sure. So we're getting pretty close to ArcViz. It's not going to be perfect. We're not doing atmosphere currently. Sure. We don't have birds flying by, that type of thing currently.
Right.
But certainly I think our quality is better than what we were able to do even in Max 5 years ago.
Right.
And this is out of the box. Everybody has access, hit the render button within very short amount of time.
Sure.
I mean, quite literally, open your model, pick your view, set the render size that you want, hit go.
Right.
And, you know, do you want it to be draft? Even draft looks very, very good,
but right.
Production level, very high level in V-Ray for Revit today. You know, within really a very short amount of time, you've got something that's on par with most, good enough to show a client, as they say, and probably better than a client's going to be looking
right.
for.
Right. But here's where I think, and I think this is the thing that, you know, a lot of people were concerned that V-Ray for Revit is going to destroy the ArcViz field. And I think that's a complete misnomer.
No.
I want to make sure that people understand that that's not the case.
Absolutely.
Because what is coming out of the ArcViz world is a whole lot more polish and a completely different use case, right?
That's right.
This is not, ArcViz is about showing really cool stuff, mainly serves marketing, right?
That's absolutely correct. I mean, they really are. The designer is going to render to use, to do design studies.
Right.
The designer is going to render to maybe get quick approval from a client on something, some design change that they're proposing. When it comes to marketing, when it comes to selling spaces, when it comes to even final images that a client may want to put on their wall, that's still all going through ArcViz.
Right.
And really all that we've done is we've facilitated a workflow that allows the ArcViz guy to spend less time doing those quick and dirty renderings that aren't really necessary for he or she to be doing.
Right.
And rather freed it up. Freed their time up to really focus on putting together a fantastic image or set of images, series of images for video, for instance.
Right.
That make much more sense, I think.
Sure.
And I think it's been successful in the trials that we've had in the firms that we've been working with. You know, the ArcViz guys are all coming back to us saying, "Hey, thanks."
Right.
Because you've freed up some of my time.
Yeah.
And now I can really focus on what's important, getting the cameras just right.
Right.
You know, we're designers. We don't necessarily know how the best way to compose a scene, for instance.
No. And you know, I think of the Arcvist guys are really sort of taking the role that some of the architectural photographers had done in the past. So they have to understand that level of skill set that's involved. And not to say necessarily the architectural photographers are not involved as well, because they take the pictures after it's built.
That's right.
And the Arcvist guy does it before, but has to have that same sensibility that an architectural photographer has. So that's really, really kind of cool. And I also think, you know, there's a lot of Photoshop that's involved in some of the Arcvist stuff, and a lot of mood and feeling, right? A lot of, like you said, like the Arcvist guys compose things to evoke an emotion about this space. And that's not necessarily what a person, an art designer and a Revit's doing. Is like, is that countertop going to be the right color? Is that going to look right? Yeah, okay. And what if, how much, ooh, that light's too bright. And maybe, oh, you know what? I didn't think about the fact that this is a super shiny floor and there's going to be the sun coming in through that angle.
And it's really funny because I've seen studies, and there's one that I've gotten, a book that came out, periodical, I'm not sure, that it showed the eye movements of the layperson versus the architect on a series of renderings. It was really interesting, exterior and interior renderings, and what that translated to. Architects go right to the architecture. Every other person who's not an architect, who's never really cared much about buildings, immediately to the entourage surrounding the building.
Right.
No one cared about the architecture, and they showed them a bunch of different views and scenes and said, react to these things. And the ones that they reacted well to were usually the ones with entourage that looked, you know, more inviting, warm,
right,
like mood type things. And mm-hmm. the architecture was kind of secondary. And the ones where the architecture is that primary sort of overarching thing in the scene, that is that coup de grace render that every architect loves to see.
Monolithic.
People were like, oh, that's nice, but
It's not a, it's fun. It doesn't give you the feeling or the mood that you want to feel.
Yeah. Right. Mood is everything. It's it's 90% mood, 10% architecture in a lot of cases. So
knowing how to frame the image, all of those things, none of that changes, right? The ArcViz specialist is going to continue to be the ArcViz specialist. Technology will enable them, may free up some of their time, may give them a little more creative freedom. Mm-hmm. And frankly, we think what we bring to the table with V-Ray for Revit, for instance, is that designers now have access to. I know designers that were always afraid to go to the ArcViz guy because there's a number associated with that, right? You're either billing a client or you're eating the cost yourself, and so there almost becomes this fear about visualization, even if you're asking them to do a quick study, you know. What's this going to cost the project? What's this going to cost me? And now that goes away.
Okay. How does it go away?
Well, they have the ability to do those quick studies on their own, rapidly, iteratively, without the need of going to
the one guy
to the high
end
viz until they
that.
Need to go to the high end viz, right?
So.
Until it's time to create that image.
Right.
For spit and polish, even, you know, direct to VR now, so that we can experience the spaces that we're doing. We support Cubic Map.
Right.
So we can render that out. Then you can go out to, you know, VR headset and experience your space as you're designing it. So the ability to do that even today is really amazing.
Huge.
That's good. That leads me to what you guys think some of the future of this, of visualization and future of where architecture technology is going. What do you think?
I'm hearing a lot of real time. I think what's fascinating to me about real time is that we've always been a part of that workflow. We may not even realize, folks may not even realize that we've been doing light baking. We've been doing, you know, texture baking for years. V-Ray has been as part of real time gaming engines. And you know, I think what we're starting to see is that these environments that we're creating in, you know, we're certainly there. We're prepared And we've got a workflow that works with real-time engines across the board.
Right.
I think we're going to be designing in some of these environments soon.
Okay.
And in fact, I would argue to some degree we already are. But I think the real-time capabilities as hardware gets better, faster, cheaper, real-time ray tracing gets more accessible. We're starting to see a lot more happen in that space. And I'm really excited by the ability to swap my materials in real time, get very realistic feedback on what's happening with that material, change the time of day and see what's happening. You know, if I change my glazing because I'm looking to meet some specific energy goal,
sure,
I want to know, you know, what kind of visual change happens in my space.
Sure.
The ability to do that in somewhat real time.
Right.
I think that's, we're at the threshold of that today.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this convergence happening within the next few years of hardware and software is going to make that much more exciting.
Sure, sure. Yeah. And I think that the thing that I think some people don't realize is that V-Ray has always been very, very good at lighting. Obviously, and it's got some really good tools like caching and all this stuff. And we, you know, one of the biggest reasons that V-Ray became successful across so many industries or in visual effects is its global illumination capabilities, right? And those capabilities translate in the real-time world. And I think that's an important part that people realize, like, oh, just going, do you try, you know, doing global illumination in real time is not trivial, right? And it's expensive and you need a really big card to do it. But if you just bake it out, then you can bake it out and put it in as a texture and you can still operate.
Work smart, not hard.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So those tools of doing that is an important part. So I think that those who are jumping into the real-time world realize that it doesn't necessarily mean you have to give up the tools that you know how to use. In fact, they can help you a great deal. What about you? What do you think some of the future of design processes, well, Ted?
I think real time's got a lot to do with it, but to kind of riff off of that, the ecosystem that you talked about earlier, I think the ecosystem of being able to operate between applications, whether that application is Unity or Rhino or SketchUp or Revit,
mm-hmm.
Max, Maya, all these different platforms, how do you go between? Is that a seamless situation? That's what everybody would like it to be. I don't want to have to think about what file format goes with what and how I can translate this, that, the other thing, mm-hmm. and I need to get this object into that program, but oh, wait a second, I have to run it through. So interoperability is huge on the architecture side.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not so much in other situations, but I would love, you know, to simplify the system of translating a model from one thing to another. I think we're starting to see that between architectural applications going from SketchUp to Rhino has become really easily done. Rhino just imports it and vice versa. Now Rhino just saves out SketchUp files.
Oh, wow.
So you can dump a Rhino file that you've created into SketchUp to edit something there and then save that out with IFC information attached to it to Revit. And Revit can read Rhino files natively, or not natively, but really well.
Mm-hmm.
So if you design something in Rhino, you can pull it into Revit now. And I think the next step is into those Viz packs like Maya and Max. Okay, how do we translate this building with this wild facade that I created in Rhino using Grasshopper in Revit and then get that over to the Viz department to visualize it for marketing? And that ecosystem is really key. And I think that, because we're fast. V-Ray is blazing fast. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the hardware is there and I think it's just getting better. So really it's not so much about the speed as much as it's about the ease of interoperability, mm-hmm. I think, is the next step. And I think that's going to play a big role in, you know, visualization in the future. Mm-hmm. So,
and then you have to hand off your stuff to someone else all
exactly.
the time, right?
Exactly.
And you, whether it's the engineer or it's the ArcViz guy, right?
Exactly. So yeah.
We have what we affectionately refer to as a digital toolbox. And it's, you know, don't be limited by one or two tools. Mm-hmm. Allow yourself to have a toolbox of different tools for different things that do them well. And what makes that possible is,
right. yeah.
you know, making things interoperable. And that's no small feat to,
right.
to do. But
in my old office, we started playing with Mudbox and ZBrush mm-hmm. And all the firm looked at that and said, why? Why would you do that? But the point isn't why, it's why not, you know? Mm-hmm. Plug it into something that it doesn't necessarily fit into and see what happens. Mm-hmm. I think you made that point yesterday, Chris, mm-hmm. in a conversation we had. And having that toolbox of stuff is key. Mm-hmm. So.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, great. All right, we're right at the right amount of time. So I want to thank you guys for being on this, and hopefully someday you guys can come over to Culver City.
Definitely.
Look forward to it.
And enjoy the weather we have there every now and then.
I need some waves too.
You need some waves? Well, we got waves. We got waves. Yeah. Just not in Venice, because then you have to ride it with those syringes and stuff like that. Oh.
Dirty surfing.
Yeah, dirty surfing. But yeah, that's actually where the Dogtown guys, they started from surfing. And do you know the story about the Dogtown skaters, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they tried to find something to do between their morning and afternoon sets. And so they started skateboarding. So anyway. All right, guys. Thanks a lot. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Cool. Thank you.